You're listening to an American Free Press podcast. Hello and welcome. Joining me on the phone from Vancouver, British Columbia, is Greg Felton, the author of the controversial book, The Host and the Parasite. Greg is an investigative journalist specializing in the Middle East, Canadian politics, the media, and language. He holds a master's degree in political science from the University of British Columbia and speaks French, Russian, and Mandarin. He's written a political column for the monthly Arabic English Canadian Arab News, and his articles have appeared on Rents.com, WhatReallyHappened.com, InformationClearinghouse.info, TheCanadianCharger.com, and in Middle East Times, Tehran Times, and other publications. Greg, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, glad to be here, Dave.
Greg, The Host and the Parasite, interesting title. Can you explain how you selected that?
Well, I was looking for a title that would encompass all the main themes of my book, and I was having a little trouble. See, I tie together four different themes. There's the history of the Zionization of America, how Israel's influence grew and grew to the point where it has virtually taken over the country. I have a history of the rise of Osama bin Laden and the Muslim reaction to Israel in the United States. I have the September the 11th attack and the aftermath of that. And I have a short number of chapters about oil in Afghanistan and the Iraq War. And I was trying to think of how I could describe the book without biasing one of those themes over the others. And I thought, well, it all has to do with Israel essentially turning the United States into its private little billy club. And Israel does, and what it gives the United States, and you come up with the answer of, well, nothing. It's a very much a parasitic relationship. Israel takes and takes and takes from America billions upon trillions of dollars in financial and material aid, and it gives America nothing. Trouble, humiliation, disrespect, contempt. And I thought, what a perfect relationship, a host and a parasite. It's a great medical metaphor. And I use a medical metaphor in my opening chapter when I talk about how the United States succumbed to the nascent reaction, the fascist movement of the 1960s and 70s. And I thought, this is the way I should go. It's a medical story. It's a healthy American country that got infected by a disease, and the parasite consumed the host to the point now where it's almost impossible to discuss the United States as an independent country, because everything it does has to be vetted by the Israel lobby, especially with respect to the Middle East and military policy. So that's how I came up with it. And the subtitle, How Israel's Fifth Column Consumed America, describes the machinations of the Israel lobby, which together with the Christian Zionist movement managed to turn the United States into a fascist theocracy. And it is that aspect of the United States history that has consumed the Republic. It has consumed whatever vestige of democratic tradition remained in the United States. So that's how it came up. I had to find a generic title, and that's what I did. I think it's a perfect title.
Yeah, it's very provocative.
Provocative works, yes.
Yeah, provocative, very provocative. Now, you used a term in your explanation just a moment ago called Zionization. What is Zionization?
Well, as you may or may not know, as your listeners may not know, there are two kinds of Jews in the world. If I could be a bit generic for a minute. There are Jews who follow the Hebrew Bible, and they live according to the traditions of the religion. And most of these people would classify as your typical liberal Jew that live in the United States, Europe, and are good citizens of whatever country they happen to live in. The other kind is a minority of very determined radicals called Zionists. And these Zionists believe that all Jews have to return to the Holy Land and claim the land that they believe God deliberately deeded for them by the great real estate agent in the sky.
Right.
Yeah, so we have the scenario where Israel needs to do this, but it can't do it by itself. It needs to have somebody else do its dirty work for them. And this became the United States. And beginning with Harry Truman in the 1948 presidential election, Israel essentially bought the White House. It bribed Truman to endorse the creation of a Jewish national home in Arab Palestine.
Right.
Well, we can get into that in a bit in a minute, but from that moment on, Israel got its hooks into the United States and began the process of turning the United States away from a democracy into being a billy club for Jewish colonial expansionism on the eastern side of the Mediterranean. So if you look, apart from the period of the Eisenhower administration and even the Kennedy administration, you can see progressively how Israel managed to get more and more influential as the United States matured after the Second World War. And we can see great strides in Zionist influence in the American government, beginning with really Ronald Reagan. Essentially, Lyndon Johnson and Ronald Reagan that really started the ball rolling toward turning America away from its democratic traditions. So I think there are six or seven, I forget the exact number, periods of Zionization in America. And right now it culminates with George W. Bush. And even though Barack Obama is now the occupant of the White House, it really isn't that much different. I mean, by the time Bush gets into power, we have the highest stage of the Zionization of America, the complete subversion of the Constitution, the destruction of civil liberties, the complete debasement of American self-interest for the interests of promoting Israeli expansionism and mass murder in Palestine. So it's a history of how the United States essentially began to disappear and be consumed.
As you state, they've become a fascist entity, haven't they?
Well, the United States became fascist. If you look what happened after the Second World War, there was a civil rights movement that grew up in the 1960s and the early 70s, and that movement became very influential. Lyndon Johnson had his Great Society programs, the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement. Essentially, it was the rise of American liberalism. It was a great period of great tolerance, great, I guess you could call it, progressive thinking in America. But as with every revolution, there are many people who take a dim view of it, and counter-revolution sets in. And it was with the Roe versus Wade decision in 1973 that the liberal movement essentially reached its high watermark, because it was in that year that the Heritage Foundation was created, which is the first right-wing Christian think tank in America. And from that moment on, the Christian right and the Jewish far left, if you can believe it, managed to form a common cause. They were economically selfish, and they were militant, pro-military, and they began to attack the belief that Americans, the average American, deserved federal support, that there should be any federal spending on welfare or unemployment or health programs. It was very much a selfish libertarian mentality that drew them together. And from this, out of this rather strange, unholy marriage, you ended up with the kernel of a fascist reaction to the progressive history of America over the previous decade. And you can trace this from the early 70s up to Ronald Reagan's election. We can see how this movement coalesced and became stronger and stronger and stronger. So by the time Jimmy Carter's presidency was on its last legs, Jerry Falwell could claim that it was the Christian Americans who put Ronald Reagan in the White House. And it is from this election, the 1980 presidential election, that we can trace the actual degeneration of the United States into a fascist state, what I call the period of proto-fascism.
Okay. And so now we're pretty much done. That's what you're saying.
Well, right now the Constitution is essentially an anti-Semitic document that has to be completely denied. I mean, there is no Constitution left. The Fourth Amendment has been repealed. Illegal search and seizure, the freedom of speech, all these are now contingent variables depending on the willingness of the government to allow it to happen. There is no America left. And this is the one thing that Americans, I think, will have trouble understanding, because you know, any country, any people in a country looks around and sees, well, this is my country. I grew up here. I recognize the symbols, the history, the traditions. But what we're looking at is essentially an illusory world. Yes, superficially, it looks like the same country that had existed before Reagan took office, but the core of the country has been hollowed out, and it's been filled with a toxic, cancerous poison. It isn't as visible as it perhaps could be, because people would rather look at the, would perhaps rather not look at it. They would rather pretend that everything is okay, that this is still my country. I can believe in the same things. But the things that they believe in have been co-opted.
Right.
The last chapter of my book, I think, pretty much says, puts this point quite clearly. And I use the metaphor from the movie The Matrix, where I talk, where Neo is being in, being taught by Morpheus near the beginning of the movie. And Morpheus tells Neo that the Matrix is all around. It's pulled over our eyes to convince us that everything is normal. And one of the hardest things for people to do is to say, tell themselves that what I see is not what is real. For people to separate the world of appearance from the world of reality, it takes a great leap of logic. And because that's so difficult, people are willing to accept the reality that's presented to them. So when you tell somebody, for example, that the United States no longer exists, that it's been taken over by a bunch of gangsters based out of Tel Aviv in Eastern Mediterranean, they'll look at you as if you had six heads. They simply will not accept it, and they'll go into cognitive denial. They'll refuse to talk to you. They'll call you an idiot, some sort of conspiracy nut. They'll basically shut down. And yet it's very easy, it's desperately easy to prove that the United States as a republic, as a democratic state, does not exist. And we know this because the United States pursues policy contrary to the national interest, and it is irrational for a country to do that. So in short, to sum up this part, Americans have to adopt an irrational frame of reference to make rational conclusions about what they see in front of them.
Are the neocons still in positions of power? Are they in Barack Obama's administration?
Well, yes, they are. I mean, if you look at the composition of Congress, they're pretty much the same people that have been in there for the past, I don't know, four or five elections. So yes, you have the same occupied legislature that does Israel's bidding. Just look at how many people will jump at the drop of a hat to write a protest letter to Obama the minute he decides to hold Israel accountable to international law. As far as the White House goes, well, we have Rahm Emanuel, who was kicked out of the Clinton White House for being a suspected Mossad spy. And of course, Rahm Emanuel is talking about leaving. At least that's what the word is from Democratic insiders, because he wants to run for mayor of New York. And he and Barack Obama have a few problems. You have Hillary Clinton, who was more Zionist than thou when she was running for president. God, she had Norman Podhoretz as one of her advisors, and he's a nasty piece of work. You have neocons still in great positions of influence in the Obama administration, but there are probably a few people there who will temper the more extreme opinions. But let's face it, Obama is no more an independent president than Topojik. As an independent human being, you know, he's not. Barack Obama still takes marching orders from the Israel lobby.
Right.
Look at the disgraceful behavior he displayed at the APEC conference. He was gushing over Israel. He was trying to love me. I love you. You've got to like me. I support Israel. It's terrible.
Right.
Barack Obama is not a president. He's Israel's governor on the Potomac.
Right. You referred to Washington D.C. is Israeli occupied territory, right? Or their colony on the Potomac.
It's Washington, Tel Aviv. That's the city.
Washington, Tel Aviv. It's actually it's an occupied government in Washington D.C.
It's an occupation. It's a governorship. It's like an imperial government where you have some satrap who is installed in some government position, who gets a lot of favors so long as he does what he's told by the bosses back in the gangster capital of Tel Aviv or Jerusalem.
Wow. These Israelis or Zionists, whatever you want to call them, I mean, this is a relatively new occurrence, Zionism, and they seem to have really taken over so thoroughly. How is that possible? I mean, didn't they really essentially start at the end of the 19th century, Zionists?
Yeah, you're correct. Zionism is a relatively recent phenomenon, dates to the latter quarter of the 19th century. In fact, the first Zionist was a Christian. In the United States, there's a man named William Eugene Blackstone, and he started the first movement to create a national homeland for Jews in Palestine, and he tried to persuade President Harrison to do that.
Right.
Harrison refused, of course, because at that time Americans could say no to Israel. It wasn't until about 7 years later or so that Theodor Herzl, a rather eccentric and rather inaccurate writer, came up with his book, The Judenstaat, which became the Bible of the Zionist movement, where he, in that book, Herzl articulated the need for a Jewish national home, that Jews couldn't get a fair shake in a Christian world. And he based that theory on the trial of Alfred Dreyfus, a French soldier who was tried and convicted on trumped-up charges and sent off to Devil's Island. However, Dreyfus was eventually exonerated and was returned with full rank to the French army, and so there was nothing came of it. I mean, it may have been because he was Jewish that there was prejudice against Jews, but the upshot is that justice prevailed and he was rehabilitated. However, that did not seem to impress Herzl, because he had died before that could happen. And so his book essentially speaks about a political movement that was based essentially on a misunderstanding of politics. But it was that book, The Judenstaat, that really became the foundation of the Jewish movement to create a Jewish political entity in Palestine, which, as I said earlier, is contrary to the teachings of the Hebrew Bible, because the prophet is not yet, the Messiah has not yet returned from wherever, and the prophet Elijah has not heralded the return of the Messiah.
Of course, there's a group called Netarai Karta that exists to make sure that Zionism doesn't exist.
That's right. Those are the Jews who are the Satmar Jews. And these are the true believers. These are the good guys. These are the really honest, accurate, believing Jews who look upon Israel as essentially a manifestation of the same sort of fascism that dominated Hitler's Germany. And they're not afraid to make direct equation between Hitler's Germany and Israel.
Right. In fact, they had some dealings together, didn't they, the early Zionists in the Third Reich?
Yeah, the Zionists were integral to the survival of the Third Reich.
How was that? How were they integral to the survival of the Third Reich?
Well, it was the Zionists, the 2% that were unique among all the Jews, that were willing to help Hitler's Germany fight the international boycott that was being led by the Jewish war veterans of America. Much as is happening today in the United States, people, longshoremen, were refusing to unload German ships because of what Germany was doing to Jews. And now, Americans are refusing to unload Israeli goods for what Israel is doing to Arabs.
Right.
It's an exact parallel.
Right.
And the Zionists were the people who helped the Nazis fight the ban and helped them economically by facilitating trade. But that's a whole other story. If you want to read about it, it's called The Transfer Agreement, written by a man named Edwin Black, himself a Zionist Jew,
right,
who articulates the corrupt nature of the Zionist relationship with Nazi Germany and how the Zionists helped the Nazis fill the concentration camps. Because let's not forget that the Zionists hated, absolutely hated, the common Yiddish-speaking Jew of Europe. They thought them to be traitors to the Jewish faith. These were people who preferred to live in Europe among Christians. And these were lower than low Jews. It was based on a terrible chauvinism, a great conceit, bigotry, superiority. It's a hateful belief system. It's indefensible in any rational society.
Zionism, it seems, is here to stay against the protestations of many people. Now, your book, The Host and the Parasite, you had said that it had panicked Canada's Israel lobby. Now, of course, the United States has their Israel lobby, which is run by APAC, which is the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. And tell our listeners about what you have up in Canada. And also, then, please let us know how it panicked that lobby.
Well, up here we have like an alphabet soup of Israel advocacy groups. We have the Jewish Community of Greater Vancouver, the Canada-Israel Committee. We have the Canadian Jewish Congress, the Canada-Israel Public Affairs Committee. We have B'nai B'rith. We have political organizations like the Liberal Parliamentarians for Israel, a little group of treasonous schmucks who think that serving a foreign government is more important than upholding their pledge to support this country.
Right.
We don't have quite as many as you have down there, but we have our share.
Right. And your book, The Host and the Parasite, it scared them a little bit, didn't it?
Well, yeah. As soon as the advertising went out, there was a furor. There were three of them, the Jewish Community of Greater Vancouver, the Canada-Israel Committee, and the Canadian Jewish Congress, all ganged up on me to try to have me sent shut down. They tried to have my speech stopped.
What speech was it?
It was a speech I gave in February 2008 about my book.
Where was it being held?
It was the Vancouver Library in Vancouver.
Right.
And the issue here, though, is that the library is a public forum. Anybody can go speak there. It has credibility because lots of people look upon the library as a place where somebody who has credibility is allowed to speak. I mean, the fact that I was being allowed to speak there essentially gave me a cachet of credibility.
Right.
And that's something that cannot happen in this country. Nobody who speaks in behalf of Palestine or against Israel can be shown any respect, whatever. And so the fact that the library was hosting me meant that I had to be attacked. The library had to be attacked.
How did they do that?
Well, they made representations to the city librarian. They demanded that I be canceled. They demanded the entire Freedom to Read movement, which was the auspices under which I was speaking, be canceled because of me. I was invited to speak at that time. See, I approached the library about speaking for a book launch party, and they said, well, no, why don't you try back in February when we have Freedom to Read? I mean, that would be the exact sort of thing we need, we could have for that event. And so, sure, I did. Well, they invite me. And the city librarian basically cut me off at the knees. I mean, he showed me great disrespect. He cut off all my advertising. He took down all the posters of the book. When he introduced me, he didn't even mention me. He was just trying to cover his own ass. And he was trying to, he was reacting to the smear tactics that appeared in the local paper. It was a libelous attack upon me in the local newspaper, the Vancouver Sun, and he was just trying to address that. He was speaking to that.
What was it? Was it an editorial, or was it?
No, it was a column. It was a full column. It was an attack upon me. It was an attack that lied about me, that misrepresented my book. It was the standard anti-Semitic rant. You know, I'm an anti-Semite, blah, 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 blah.
Right. Are you an anti-Semite?
Of course not. The term is a meaningless term anyway.
Okay.
The upshot is that the library was basically read the Riot Act. And so at the time my speech came up, I was allowed to speak not because the library respected me. They clearly didn't. They behaved abysmally toward me. But they had to save their own reputation because they could not be seen to be intimidated by any lobby group, even the Israeli lobby group. So I was allowed to speak, and that was it.
Right. Libraries are supposed to be a place where we can come and exchange ideas, aren't they?
Well, it is free, but unfortunately, freedom comes with a price in this country. Israel, like in the United States, manages to determine what is or is not free expression. And I think it's rather pathetic that three large organizations ganged up on one speaker because they're afraid of what I have to say. And I think that says a lot for the intellectual credibility of the state of Israel. Since 1948, Israel has always been afraid of criticism because Israelis know that they are not legitimate. And I go in this book, in the Host and the Parasite, I demonstrate not only the illegitimacy of Israel, but the way it is forcing countries to become illegitimate on their own terms.
Right. And let me mention briefly that the Host and the Parasite can be ordered by calling 1-888-699-NEWS. That's 1-888-699-NEWS, which translates to 6397. 888-699-6397. That's for our listeners in the United States, and for outside of the United States, you can call 202-547-5585. That's 202-547-5585. And that's a number for American Free Press down in Washington, D.C. And you can also visit their website if you have access to the internet at AmericanFreePress.net. And one of the tabs up top says bookstore. And you could pick that book up, The Host and the Parasite, right there. Go ahead, Greg. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. I was just speaking about the degree to which Israel is afraid of criticism. Yeah. The tyrant, there's a great line, and it's a bit of it's a cliche everybody knows, that the pen is mightier than the sword. Well, it's true. Israel is more afraid of informed, critical opinion than it is of rockets or bullets. Rockets and bullets can be fought. Words can't. If you want to stop an idea, if you want to stop an opinion, you have to commit your resources to everywhere. You have to wage an all-out campaign to exterminate an idea. And once you try to exterminate an idea, you try to exterminate people. And right. Israel is fighting a losing battle, trying to keep the world from learning just what sort of a parasitic, fascistic state it really is. Right. And this is why my book has been attacked. As much as it has.
You have a chapter in there on 9/11. And very recently, in fact, in March, the former director of the U.S. Army War College, Alan Zabrowski, made his views public when he thought that 9/11, he's 100% sure that 9/11 was a Mossad operation. Now, your chapter speaks about 9/11, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. I mean, I'm not the first person to write on it, and I'm sure there are many people out there like Barry Zwicker or David Ray Griffin who could go into greater detail and be far more comprehensive than I. But my purpose in writing this book, this particular chapter, was to demonstrate how Israel managed to consolidate its control over the United States. The one thing I do is, first of all, I demonstrate that the official narrative is a fraud, and that's not difficult to do. Anybody can do that. And I look at how the buildings collapsed, and I have, and I demonstrate that there was no physical way that steel can melt and bring a building down. It's physically impossible. But what's interesting about September the 11th is not really the event itself. What's interesting is what happened afterwards, because soon after the event, within 6 weeks, the Patriot Act was passed. And this was passed virtually unread by anybody in Congress. It was sort of presented to them as a fait accompli. Like a bunch of trained SEALs, they approved it.
Right.
Because they were stampeded into it by the specter of terrorism. The whole country was stampeded into surrendering their constitutional rights. And there's a great parallel between the September the 11th attack and the burning of the Reichstag in Germany, which allowed Hitler to come to power and to pass the enabling laws that essentially emasculated the German state's democratic constitution. What's interesting here from my perspective is that the Patriot Act didn't essentially come about because of September the 11th. September the 11th was made necessary. It was necessary in order that the Patriot Act be passed. See, I look at it from the opposite point of view.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a fact of cause and effect. It was cause and pretext. Because with the Patriot Act passed, the United States could suspend the Constitution with respect to search and seizure, freedom of expression, and all sorts of things. Habeas corpus, which is not in the Constitution, but it's part of American legal tradition.
Right.
Because it's what Israel wants. This was the only way the Israel lobby could get what it wants, was to force the United States to repudiate its own Constitution. And so my argument is, and I look at the cause of it, I mean, you're looking at the people who are behind this whole thing. You look at, for example, Larry Silverstein, who is the owner of the World Trade Center, and Louis Eisenberg, who is the landlord, the New York and New Jersey Port Authority.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a very interesting theory about why the building was brought down. Because if you look at the case of Larry Silverstein, he had a white elephant on his hands. He wanted to tear the buildings down and rebuild them because they were toxic. They had asbestos insulation. They were put up before asbestos was banned as building insulation. So there's an argument to be made here that this attack was partly a real estate swindle. Because what does Larry Silverstein do the minute these buildings come down? He appeals for insurance relief from Swiss Re. And mm-hmm. He gets it.
Is Silverstein a Zionist?
Well, I think so, yeah. He has had a long connection with the Zionist organizations and Zionist political figures in Israel.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a scenario where nothing the official narrative of September 11th makes any sense. And you look at the result of it, and because September 11th was a fraud, and the result of that fraud is the Patriot Act, and it's because the Patriot Act, the United States has been allowed to get away with wholesale unconstitutional behavior, you have to look at, I think, from a different perspective. And once you realize that the parasite had gotten into the host so deeply by the beginning of the 1990s, that everything the United States did had to be seen through the eyes of Israeli self-interest. Because really, America had no self-interest, no national self-interest. See, it was in Ronald Reagan's presidency that the chief aim of American policy in the Middle East shifted from secure oil supply to serving Israel's expansionist needs.
Wow.
But I think what's interesting from my book, what people do like, is the comprehensive nature of my analysis of all the parts of the American government since 1948 all come together.
Mm-hmm.
I think I do a fairly decent job of showing how the Afghan war got the United States involved, how that helped develop Osama bin Laden, how bin Laden became America's official bogeyman. He was reinvented as America's official bogeyman because the United States wanted to coerce the Afghan government into allowing a pipeline to be laid across this land from Turkmenistan to Pakistan.
Mm-hmm.
And because the government of the day in Afghanistan, which was the Taliban, refused to play ball, overnight these Taliban went from being friends, publicly unadmitted friends, but friends nevertheless, into implacable enemies. See, if the Taliban had allowed this to happen, we would not be at war in Afghanistan right now. And the petropolitics is what made the Taliban the enemy.
The Host and the Parasite, How Israel's Fifth Column Consumed America by Greg Felton. And, of course, you can get your copy by calling 1-888-699-NEWS. That's 1-888-699-6397 within the United States. If you're abroad, you can call the Washington, D.C. number. That's 202-547-5585, 202-547-5585. And of course, if you have access to the Internet, you can go to AmericanFreePress.net and click on the Bookstore tab, and you can order it from there. Greg, what does the future look like for the United States?
Doesn't look good. Again, it all depends what sort of timeline you look at. I mean, if you look at the Roman Empire with the rise of Caligula, you look at a bunch of idiots that would survive for decades upon decades until the empire collapsed. Americans are going to have to wake up to the fact that they don't have a country, that they are being victimized by a foreign group, a foreign lobby group. And whether the Americans can take up arms to throw over the government to declare a new revolution, I don't know. Will Americans have enough courage to do that? Because that's certainly what you need. The American political system is so corrupt. It's been so shot through with occupation, with propaganda, with Zionism, that you don't have people who can speak for Americans. You look at groups like like Monsanto or organizations which serve the interests of big business, they come and go out of government like a revolving door.
Right.
because the Israel lobby's money and influence basically put people into power, you don't have any real elected officials. I mean, it's like looking at the Sopranos and looking at Sopranos running America and having all the gangsters running the show and having all the sycophants trying to ingratiate themselves into the Don's good graces. And you don't have a government. You have a gangster plutocracy.
Right.
There has to be, the American government has to be, America is dead. Let's admit that it's dead and start over.
And it's mostly because of the Zionists.
The Zionists made it, really killed it. I mean, America was, it's always been, it's always had a very selfish, rather bizarre national ethos. But the United States has never been psychotic. America is now psychotic.
But does it make sense for the parasite to kill the host?
Well, it's not so much that it makes sense to kill the host, but the parasite can only do what it does. It's atavistic. It will kill the host because it's too stupid to know anything else. It will kill the host because all it can do is eat and consume. It has no respect for the host. It doesn't think, oh, gee, maybe I should stop and give it a break. No, Israel can't do that. Israel knows. Israel is a machine. It has no conscience. It has no cognitive ability to do that. It will continue to take and take until there is no more. And how long the American public and the American government will put up with it, I don't know. How long the intimidation and the vacuous slur of anti-Semitism will continue to have influence in America, I don't know.
But it doesn't look good.
It doesn't look good. Not until we see people with guns start taking aim at the cancer that has ripped their country apart, that has polluted their culture, that has impoverished their land. I mean, Americans will go without food. They will go without clothing. They will go without housing. They will go without insurance. But Israel will never want for anything. And because of that, Americans have to stand up for themselves. And if they're not prepared to do it, I don't know what the future holds for the United States.
Well, I guess the first place to start is to get your copy of The Host and the Parasite and find out really how deeply infected the United States is with this parasite. 888-699-NEWS, 888-699-NEWS, within the United States, outside the United States, 202-547-5585, 202-547-5585, or on the internet at AmericanFreePress.net, and just click on the bookstore tab. Greg Felton, I want to thank you so much for spending the time with us and talking about your book, The Host and the Parasite, and hope to have you back again, Greg.
Well, hope to be back, David. It's been good talking to you.
Thanks, Greg.
Okay.
Take care.